This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Hi, this is your old pal Marcus from Los Angeles, California. The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like you and me. If you'd like to donate to help support the show, visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, I'm Jesse Thorne, and this is The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org.
Radio sweetheart on the airways, it's the sound of young America.
Dougal, I'll tell you something happened to me once. It was years ago. I was staying with my great-aunt in her house in Connemara, which is a big house miles from anywhere. Apparently, during the Great Famine, a cruel landlord and his beautiful daughter used to live there. The story is that he forbade the daughter from marrying a young soldier. It broke her heart, and in her despair, she hung herself in her bedroom. The room that I was staying in was that very bedroom. I remember it was icy cold and lit by a single candle. I was drifting off to sleep when suddenly I heard a strange creaking noise from the far corner of the room.
Was it a ghost?
No. So no, I've never seen a ghost.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program, Graham Linehan, is the writer and co-creator of a number of British television series. At the age of 25, he co-created, along with Arthur Matthews, the now classic sitcom Father Ted. He created Black Books, a cult favorite here in the United States, and another legendary series in the UK. And most recently, he's been working on The IT Crowd. You're shooting, what, the third season, or the third series, I should say, right now there, right?
Yeah, that's right. Third series. So we're on episode 3.
And the first and second.
I'm kidding.
The first and second series are currently running on the Independent Film Channel here in the United States. Graham, welcome to The Sound of Young America.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. You started your writing career quite young as a journalist, as a columnist. At the time, did you imagine for yourself a career in comedy?
No, I just kind of slipped into it because when I got to England, Ireland was a very small pond, so I had a kind of free rein to write whatever kind of journalism I wanted to write and to write about the bands I wanted to write about. And as soon as I got to England, that changed and I wasn't really allowed to write in my style. I used to use the personal pronoun a lot. You know, I used to say I did this, I did that, and use it, because I was a big Woody Allen fan and I used to use it to make fun of myself. And as soon as I arrived in this English magazine, one of the first things I saw was a memo saying that no one was allowed to use the word I in any of their pieces. So I was basically immediately emasculated as a comic writer. So so I quickly got frustrated with all that. And a friend of mine, Arthur Matthews, we'd been writing some comedy together in Ireland, and we thought we'd give it a go.
How did you conceive of Father Ted?
Well, Arthur, my writing partner, he used to do Father Ted as a stand-up character, we just always liked the guy's voice. It struck us as quite an amusing kind of tone, and funny lines seemed to kind of just appear whenever Arthur was using this voice. You know, he used to do gigs, and he'd say things like, if anyone at the back can't see, say hello to them. They're from St. Kevin's School for the Blind, you know, and he'd do gags like this. And it was just a very light. I observed as well among my family and friends that, you know, when you're a kid, your parents with their friends, they tend to speak in this kind of light, kind of oddly superficial way, as if they're scared of talking about anything deeper than the weather. And I always found that quite funny, the way they'd try and avoid any kind of dark subject whatsoever. And that lent itself nicely to Ted, who's always, you know, trying to steer the conversation away from things he actually doesn't know anything about, like religion. You know, he doesn't want to think about it too much because he knows it doesn't really make sense, a lot of it.
There you are. I hope you had a nice chat.
Oh, it was great.
I think I reached some very interesting conclusions.
Oh, about what exactly?
Well, it's nonsense, isn't it?
What is?
Religion. Well, think about it. Very little evidence. Blind faith, that's all we have to go on. There's not a shred of proof anywhere, nothing. Aliens? Now, there's something that might just be possible. Everlasting life? Big demons sticking red-hot pokers up your ass for all eternity? I don't think so. The whole religion thing, I just don't buy it.
Were there figures in your childhood that informed that character?
Not really, no. But there were, I guess, there was an element of, you know, I was taught by the Marist fathers in Ireland, and we had the occasional hip priest who'd try and do a folk mass by getting everyone to sit in a circle and listen to U2 songs and stuff like this, and it was kind of that embarrassment and that kind of. Trying to be hip thing. I guess that kind of some of that went into Ted, but really it was more my family and friends, and you know, my mum was a big influence on Mrs. Doyle, the housekeeper, who's so polite. She can't really get through a conversation without offering anyone tea or something like that. And basically, it was really just observing the world of adults, I guess, you know, in Ireland when you're growing up, you know. I mean, I don't think I ever heard a serious discussion amongst adults, you know, when I was a teenager, you know.
Do you think that there was something that was particularly Irish about it? Was it in any way a reaction to moving to England from Ireland?
No. In fact, I always swore I would never write anything about priests or anything like, or the countryside, because I hated all that stuff growing up in Ireland. The things that I was obsessed with at the time were, you know, were the things that everybody is of my generation is obsessed with, The Simpsons and Star Wars and you know, British TV comedies, American TV comedies. You know, the Ted was actually more of a we really wanted to do a live action cartoon, and The Simpsons was very much in our head of television. That was the other problem with a lot of sitcoms is that they're often more like radio shows. You know, they're not very visual. And The Simpsons, we used to watch The Simpsons and just think, why aren't more TV shows as visual as this? You know, and. And of course, the answer, as we soon found out, was because it's very expensive, you know.
Most of the television series that are live action that have followed in the steps of The Simpsons, shows like, you know, Malcolm in the Middle or Scrubs, that sort of wear that Simpsons influence on their sleeve, are single camera sitcoms, and you've been very committed to the traditional live audience sitcom format. Why was it the choice for you?
Well, I guess first of all, it's possibly to do with habit, because we started off on Ted with an audience, and it just kind of, you know, it's something I'm used to and it's something I enjoy, but. You know, there's occasionally I'll read something online or someone will say, you know, why do we need a laugh track? We don't need to be told when to laugh. And that's not really why I use one. The reason I use one is because every week you rehearse the show into a state where you're hoping that the audience will laugh at nearly every second thing that's said by one of your characters. And that pressure, it really, really, you know, piles on when you know you're going to have to do it in front of a studio audience on Friday. So it kind of forces us to be funny, and it forces the comedy into, you know, I guess more of a gag-based area. And that's where I kind of like it, you know. I like gags. I like big performances. I like, you know, things that are larger than life. And And I think it just puts me under a lot of pressure to make sure the show is as funny as possible, knowing it's going to go in front of an audience, you know. That said, I love Malcolm in the Middle, and I think they do a great job of doing it without, you know, they just seem to be able to do it without any of that. But in their case, I guess they probably have more than one writer, you know. But it's kind of hard for me to, in a vacuum, just think, well, I'm going to write a really, really funny show, you know, on my own, and, you know, and not have an audience to kind of force me into coming up with better gags, you know.
Do you feel like that pressure ever is negative? Like, do you feel like you lose something by feeling that pressure that everything has to be funny?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the thing about audiences is often you have to kind of ignore them, you know, because sometimes out of nervousness or a desire to please, they'll laugh at things that aren't actually jokes, you know. So that's the worst thing, because the audience at home just sees something that's not funny and wonders why there's laughter. And I think it's one of the things that's led to this myth of canned laughter, which I'm constantly complaining about, you know, and I'm constantly asking the audiences who come to my show, will you please write on your blogs or letters to the editor or whatever, just tell them you exist and you were here and you were actually laughing, you know. But it's those moments that, as I say, when an audience laughs out of nervousness or because they're not used to the rhythm of a show, and you know, sometimes you can make the mistake of actually thinking, oh well, that laugh is deserved, I'm going to leave it in, and it's not. It's just there's one thing in an episode I'm otherwise very proud of the IT crowd called The Work Editing, where Roy is in a disabled toilet and the camera, it just opens and you just see him in the toilet and the audience laughs, you know. And for some reason, I left it in. And I look back at it and I think, what the hell did I keep that in for? You know, because it's just the oddest thing, an audience laughing at a man in the toilet, you know. But it could be just a British propensity for toilet humor, you know.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Graham Linehan, is the creator of Father Ted, maybe the most important UK television series of the last 15 years. His new show, The IT Crowd, is currently running on IFC. The sitcom is a very particular format, which requires, unlike, say, sketch comedy, which really all you're asking of it is to be funny, it requires you to create a world that viewers want to come back to over and over again, a sort of a place where viewers want to live.
Where everybody knows your name.
Exactly. Not to put too fine a point on it, but yes. How do you achieve that when you're doing a series that has a fair amount of surreality to it and some big silliness?
God, I don't know. I mean, I think basically you just cast, obviously according to to how funny someone is, but also, you know, whether they have a bit of warmth to them, you know. I mean the reason that Father Ted was as big a success as it was over here was because there was a lot of warmth in the relationship between Ted and Dougal. It was almost paternal, you know, how Ted felt about Dougal. And in fact, if you look at Father Ted, despite this kind of situation being about three priests and a housekeeper, it's actually kind of like a family. You've got a father and a mother and a kid and a grandfather. And I think it's things like that we didn't realize we were doing that, by the way. We didn't do that deliberately, but all these pieces just fell into place and suddenly we realized we had a little family. And I think things like that work on a subconscious level and make people very, they make people comfortable enough that they're able to laugh at the jokes. It's kind of the difference, I think, you'll find between The Simpsons and Futurama. You know, The Simpsons is a family and everyone feels very comfortable. They know where they are and they kind of enjoy the show. Because of how recognizable it is as a situation. But with Futurama, which kind of is about a bunch of 20-somethings who are kind of hanging around together, it's harder to define those relationships and it's harder to see where you are with it. And I think it's one of the reasons why Futurama wasn't as big a success.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Graham Linehan. He's the creator of the television programs Father Ted and The IT Crowd. We'll have more with Graham in just a minute on The Sound of Young America from PRI, Public Radio International.
Production of The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
The Sound of Young America Forum is now open for business at MaximumFun.org. Join other listeners and yours truly in discussing the latest shows or the latest happenings in culture and the arts. Just visit MaximumFun.org and click on Forum. Welcome back to The Sound of Young America, a public radio show about things that are awesome. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the show, Graham Linehan, created Father Ted, probably the most important British comedy series the past 15 or 20 years. You've also written for the first season of this of a very funny sketch series called Big Train, and contributed material to The Day Today and Brass Eye, which are two of the certainly two of the funniest television programs I've ever seen, but are also among the least warm television series that I've ever seen. They're news satires, which are absolutely unsparing and unrelenting, and also spectacularly, almost unfathomably funny.
UK used to mean United Kingdom, but ask anyone today and they'll tell you it stands for Unbelievable Crime Wave.
No one is safe. By the end of tomorrow, one or all of these people may have been set on fire, bum-raped, or burgled senseless by Britain's marauding criminals. This month, police pictures showed another estate in Manchester turning itself into a gun. So much for recorded crimes, but crimes we know nothing about are going up as well. What hope do we have of battering these down?
What was it like to write for those kind of shows relative to writing for a warm-hearted sitcom about some Daffy priests on an island?
I guess it's more like in the case of The Day Today and Brass Eye, it's slightly more like the American model in that it would be a room full of people on The Day Today pitching ideas, and on Brass Eye it was Arthur and I and Chris Morris just chucking things back and forth. I love that system. You know, I'm not. There's a bit of preciousness over here. We're very proud of the fact that we don't use the writing teams to make our TV shows and so on. But at the same time, I really like the idea of a writing team. I love the kind of one-upmanship of sitting around the table and trying to think of something funnier than the thing the previous person said. You know, it really brings out the best in me. And it's just a blast. But for different reasons than this. Then the sitcoms are a blast, you know. Yeah. Little short moments of fun, you know, that rather than a sustained, opera, you know, where everything has to be. Sitcoms, you have to tie things together and make sure that everything's consistent and, you know, the characters are behaving on some level in a realistic manner. Whereas with sketch shows, each sketch presents a different problem and a different way of writing and you know, that's... It keeps you on your toes, and it's a lot of fun, you know.
Are there things that you contributed to Brass Eye or The Day Today that you're particularly proud of?
It's funny, cause, yeah. I guess on Brass Eye, we had this gangster in called Mad Frankie Fraser, and we asked him to graph how we gave him a thing called a Mad Frankie Fraser machine or something, and we asked him to graph mark how mad certain things made him, and to get him to join in with that was a lot of fun. We got celebrities to read out prepared statements to the camera that were just ridiculous, you know, and it was just the feeling of power of seeing someone facing the camera and reading something out that it just makes no sense whatsoever. It was wonderful, you know. But with Chris, I my favorite things are always the more surreal, less mean things, you know, the kind of things that make me laugh out loud are the lighter things, you know. Like I remember one, it's just a shot of a bus traveling along, and Chris's voiceover says, in something about being kind to animals, and it says something like, in 1972, 6,000 flies were given a free holiday. There's presumably inside this bus, you know, and things like that just really tickle me.
Tell me about how you came to write the IT Crowd. You'd been relatively quiet in television for a few years.
Trying to bang my head against the closed door of cinema.
Let's start with that. What was the challenge of writing film for you when you'd already been extremely successful writing television?
Well, that you the kind of answers in the question there. I mean, I just felt, well, I've kind of done it. I've proved I can do it, and now it's time to see it. Because basically, we wrote an hour-long Christmas special for Father Ted, and I was astonished at how difficult it was to write as soon as it got over 40 minutes. Suddenly, it just got really unwieldy, and I realized, oh, wow, well, this is all these are all the things that I need to learn if I'm going to be able to write films. And so I tried it for a while, and I don't know, it kind of, I wrote a couple of things, and, you know, it's just the financing and all that sort of thing. It's too time-consuming and annoying. So I finally gave up on it, and I realized, wow, if I come up with a sitcom idea, I'll probably be able to get it on TV next year because of the success of Ted and things like that. And that kind of really lit a fire under me, you know. And also, I have to say, you know, it was partly to do with two things. It was kind of to do with meeting my wife and the idea of a woman coming into a very male environment and disrupting it started to interest me. And I was really becoming a big fan of sites like Boing Boing and noticing how the internet was changing things. And I thought, this is kind of stuff that people aren't really doing any comedy about, and maybe I can be the first. And I was kind of toying with it, and then one day my wife said, you could call it the IT Crowd or the IT Crowd. And when you have a good title, then suddenly everything, you know, it's like God saying, you know what, you should write this right now, because you need to get something out that has a title that good. Maybe it doesn't seem good to anyone else, but I loved it. As soon as I heard it, something clicked inside me, and the show was a little bit easier to write as a result.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Graham Linehan, is the creator of the British sitcoms Father Ted and the IT Crowd.
So! First date?
Yes.
Scary?
Yes.
Don't be scared.
Well, I'm not really scared.
You should be.
Well, I'm a little bit scared.
Well, don't be!
Make up your mind.
So here you are.
Yes, really looking forward to getting to grips with...
I'm going to put you in IT, because you said on your CV you have a lot of experience with computers.
I did say that on my CV, yes. I have a lot of experience with the whole computer thing, you know, emails, sending emails, receiving emails, deleting emails. I could go on.
Do.
The web. Using mouse, mices, using mice. Clicking, double clicking. The computer screen, of course, the keyboard, the bit that goes on the floor down there.
The hard drive.
Correct.
Uh-huh. Well, you certainly seem to know your stuff. That's settled. Got a good feeling about you, Jen, and they need a new manager.
The setup of this show is two IT trouble desk employees for a large organization who work in a sort of underground den in the building of this organization. And they're assigned a middle manager who, as you said, sort of invades their space. How did you approach writing these two guys in a way that wasn't just, that wasn't just a pile of nerd cliches?
Well, the thing I tried to do was I tried to make the nerd stuff the background rather than bringing it up front. So there's a thing I call penetration, which is if you're writing about an area that's in any way you know, what's the word? If you're writing about an area that's unique in any way, then the things you have to write about are things that penetrate into people's lives. So I wouldn't write something about, for instance, one of the nerds, deciding to switch over to a Mac rather than a PC, deciding to learn how to write CSS or whatever it happens
maybe
to be.
Maybe picking a build of Linux.
Exactly. Anything like that. So I had to avoid stuff like that and talk about things that people immediately, you know, grasped, like Facebook or there's something that Boing Boing has always been very interested in, which is copyright and copyright issues and downloading movies and stuff like this. So it was all those types of things I felt, you know, people would be people would have some kind of glimmer of knowledge about. And so as a result, I kept all the kind of nerd references and all the kind of heavy geek stuff. That's kind of the set dressing, you know? So people can, you know, the people who the show is about can enjoy all that stuff on one level, while everyone else can just enjoy the comedy and ignore that stuff, you know? But I would say, in a way, you know, part of the thing that made me want to do it was I did want to write a show that had as its central figure a real uber geek, you know, just someone who had the voice and the glasses and the whole feel. You know, I just wanted to write for that kind of character. And Richard Iowetti, who plays Moss, the show in a way was built around him. I cast him before anyone else, and in conjunction with the title, he was another thing that kind of made me think, oh, this is coming together, you know.
Hello, IT. Have you tried turning it off and on again? Okay, well, the button on the side, is it glowing? Yeah, you need to turn it on. The button turns it on? Yeah. You do know how a button works, don't you? No, not on clothes.
Hello, IT. Yeah, huh? Have you tried forcing an unexpected reboot?
No, there you go. No, there you go. I just heard it come on. No, that's the music you hear when it comes on. No, that's the music you hear when it... I'm sorry, are you from the past?
Do you relate to Richard Iowetti's foil more than you do to him?
Well, I tell, the thing about it is, Richard is me aged about 16, and Chris is me aged about 25. So, you know, it's great having them together, having arguments, because it's kind of a nice, pleasantly schizophrenic feeling, you know? Because there's still things that Moss would be into that I still like, you know? And I guess it's two kind of geeks, you know? It's the computer games loving, computer loving geek on one side, who likes science fiction and Dungeons and Dragons and all that sort of thing. And then on the other side is the kind of music store geek, who's kind of rude and snobbish about their tastes and that kind of thing. And I just thought that it was a nice combo.
The kind of guy who might quit the journalism business because he wasn't allowed to... use the first person pronoun.
Yeah, exactly. And to be honest with you, I'm not really usually a fan of writing characters that are too close to myself, but I felt I could do it with Chris and the character of Roy, because I thought it would be, I could put him, I thought I could torture him, and I wanted to torture my younger self because I'm kind of ashamed of who I was. You know, like I used to be you know, my love life, for instance, was an absolute car wreck, you know, and I thought, wow, I can write about all that kind of misery that both happened to me and that I spread, and I can kind of make amends for it to some extent. So even though he's based on me, I feel I have enough distance from him to be able to really put him through the ringer, you know.
In a classic sitcom setup, if I imagine this as a new fall sitcom on CBS here in the United States, the counterpoint to these two nerds or geeks would be a spectacularly beautiful woman who's got it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And the joke
would
be
called the Big
geeks.
Bang Theory.
I just said nothing of the kind. I'm still trying to get it. There's a couple people from CBS that I want to get on this show. but your female lead, Jen, is in a very different way as flawed as these two central geeks.
Yeah.
Was that a self-conscious choice?
Yeah, it was, because there's nothing I hate more than the female character whose job is to comment on how crazy the men are or how silly the men are. It's something that I loved about Friends, for example. You had three female characters who were, in their various different ways, very, very flawed. And it's what makes a good character, you know. Basically, Marge on The Simpsons, I always think Marge is kind of the least interesting character because she's not flawed enough. Her flaws aren't quite pronounced enough, you know. And it's maybe why I'd say if you asked a million people, you know, who their favorite character is, I don't think Maude would be in anyone's top three, you know. But Marge, what am I saying? Not Maude, Marge. And so, you know, it's kind of important for me as well to ignore any feelings of political correctness and write a female character who is, you know, positive, because I think it just stops women being funny in comedies, you know. So I've been trying to find every series. I'm always speaking to Catherine and kind of hunting around for anything she does that she considers negative about herself, and I'm looking for negative things about myself that I can give to her. And you know, it's just because it's funny, you know. Negative stuff is funny. I mean, even the, you know, last series there was a throwaway joke where Jen said, quite seriously, because she's been told this by Ryan Moss, that if you type the word Google into Google, then you'll break the internet. And that kind of, that one line made me realize, you know, why am I doing more jokes about Jen not understanding computers and being particularly thick when it comes to computers? Because it's an incredibly rich vein that I haven't touched yet, you know. So this new series, kind of a couple of episodes, just popped into existence because of that new facet, you know. So it's kind of every time I do a series, I'm writing notes for the next one, you know, and thinking of more directions they can go in.
I heard you describe not wanting to do an Irish show. And I heard you, you know, we've just been talking about portraying nerds and geeks on TV and, you know, and portraying women who are afraid of technology. Is it scary to you to be making characters on TV that can easily be seen to fall into types?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think, early on the IT crowd, we were getting reviews that said things like, you know, oh, well, guess what? There's a guy with glasses who's, you know, and as if, you know, this is just such an easy thing to do and it was so cheap and beneath anyone's consideration. But to me, that was a starting off point. I made the first joke about Moss deliberately as route one, you know, or as we call it, Moss 101 as possible, you know, just something that was really, really proper, you know, route one geek stuff. And it was because I just wanted to get the audience settled. I wanted to say to him, look, here's who he is. Now we can have some proper fun with him, you know. I don't really mind about that stuff. Ted was the same. We got a few early complaints that we were dealing in what the Irish call paddywhackery, you know. But what they didn't know is we were actually being very careful to avoid certain things. We really kept the amount of traditional Irish music down to a minimum, because I always say to my, I hate traditional Irish music. To me, it's the sound of madness, you know. And little touches like this would be the ways that we kind of invisibly made sure that the show didn't descend into, as they say, paddywhackery. You know, it's the same thing with this. There's things I'm avoiding. There's things I'm not writing that I could do, but as I say, I've kind of done the Route 1 stuff as the introduction to the character, and now it's time to move on and have more fun with them.
Well, Graham, thank you so much for taking the time to be on The Sound of Young America. It was really fun to have you.
Oh, thank you, Jesse. I hope that wasn't as boring as it sounded in my head.
Graham Linehan is the creator of the IT Crowd, which is currently running on IFC television in the United States Tuesday nights. He also created Father Ted and Black Books, or I should say co-created, which are both fantastically hilarious and worth seeking out in various digital media, whatever country you live in. Thanks again, Graham.
Thank you, Jesse.
Before we go, a quick podcast-only question for the comedy super nerds. I have one more question, which is for the comedy nerds who listen to the podcast. Chris Morris was featured on season one of the IT Crowd, but made his exit.
Yeah.
Especially over here, where he's about as marginal a figure as you could possibly imagine.
Right.
People are just kind of wondering, what's that dude up to?
Oh, wow. Well, he's doing something really interesting. All I can say is go to Warp Films online. Google Warp Films, and I think you'll be able to find out a bit more. The thing about Chris is he kind of swears all his friends to silence on what he's doing, so I never know how much I'm able to say about things. All I'll say is I think basically he's doing a film is what I know, and it needs funding. And Warp Films is coming up with a very interesting way of getting that funding, you know. I don't think I can say anything more about it, because the other thing is Chris lies to everybody so that you won't know. He'll say, oh, it's a game show, you know, just to throw you off the scent, you know. So you can never really be absolutely sure with Chris that you're actually he is actually telling you the truth. So I might repeat it and then be totally off the totally wrong.
That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our theme music written and performed by Dan Grayson with help from myself. Interstitial music provided by Dan Wally. Our intern, Casey O'Brien. Editor in Chicago, Nick White. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, where you will find the vast archive of past Sound of Young America programs, among other things. You can always email me directly if you have thoughts about the show, jesse@MaximumFun.org, or you can post them on our forums. We'll see you next time on The Sound of Young America.
This message comes from Schwab. It's easy to invest in ideas you believe in with Schwab Investing Themes, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, and electric vehicles. Choose from over 40 customizable themes. More at schwab.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths, wherever you get your podcasts.